You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. That is, of course, Don't Take Me Alive from Steely Dan's 1976 album, The Royal Scam.
I know you're out there with rage in your eyes and your megaphones.
The song features the guitar stylings of Larry Carlton. My guests today are two genius musicians whose artistry has contributed to some of the most memorable songs of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, leaving an indelible mark on the music world. Steve Gadd is one of the most influential drummers of all time. Known for bridging jazz, rock, and blues, Gadd's artistry can be heard on songs like Paul Simon's 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover and Steely Dan's Asia. This is Steve Gadd with his band The Gadd Gang playing Things Ain't What They Used to Be, from the group's 1988 album, Here and Now. Steve Gadd has been a studio musician for countless artists from Carly Simon to Aretha Franklin, and has toured with Eric Clapton, James Taylor, Joe Cocker, Maynard Ferguson, Paul Simon, and many, many more. But first, my conversation with four-time Grammy winner Larry Carlton. That's him playing his song, Nightcrawler, from his self-titled 1978 solo album. Carlton is a jazz and rock guitarist who has played on over 3,000 recording sessions with everyone from Barbra Streisand and Sammy Davis Jr. to Michael Jackson and Joni Mitchell. Among the songs he is most famous for is Steely Dan's Kid Charlemagne, which Rolling Stone named as one of the best guitar solos in rock music. Larry Carlton is also a member of legendary rock group The Crusaders and even co-wrote the theme songs for the TV shows Hill Street Blues and Who's the Boss. If that wasn't enough, the prolific guitarist has enjoyed an impressive solo career. I was curious how a musician that has offered such extraordinary support to others came to prioritize his own music and write his own songs.
I didn't start writing songs till I had a record deal. I didn't pursue being a solo artist. In the 70s, you know, I was so busy doing sessions, and that started early in 1970, and by 1977, I was already kind of burned out. I was doing, you know, 500 sessions a year, charging double scale for all of those, so I couldn't charge any more money, and I was just getting kind of burned out. And in my teen years, I was a club player. I played jazz in a club, and that was my passion. So I just started telling everybody that was calling me for sessions in 1977 that I'm not doing sessions anymore. I'm going to start producing and just playing. So I took a gig in North Hollywood at a jazz club on Tuesday nights. And I was approached by a record producer from CBS. And he said, "You thought about making a record?" And that's how my solo career really started, by an offer that I wasn't looking for.
So when you say about being burned out on the sessions thing, I would imagine that a time comes, the phone rings, and you hang up the phone and go, "Oh my God, like, this is how you know you've made it. This is how you know you're at the upper echelon of the music business, because it's Quincy Jones or whoever's on the phone where you sit there and go, my God, look at where I'm going." Yeah. Was there a moment like that for you?
Mostly early in my career. Pretty soon you get used to the clientele you're working with, and it just becomes a daily, "Oh yeah, I got a session from Steely Dan. I got a session next week from Quincy." And it becomes the norm. But early in my career, yes, there were those days of realizing, my Lord, look at my date book for the next 3 months. I'm busy. Yeah. Thankful and busy.
And people that you were just super admiring of, like when you're in the room with them and you're saying, "This is fun." I mean, they're great musicians and great artists. And
yeah, that was another thing I realized. To get to play with some of the world's greatest musicians every day just raises the level that you already have an aptitude for, because you're surrounded by that quality, you know.
Now, your mother, I read, had a guitar laying around, and she played guitar, and you picked up the guitar when you were, what, 6 years old?
Yeah.
Now, fooling around with a guitar and playing with a guitar like a toy, and then many, many people put it down and they never pursue it, and then there's people who something happens. Is that nature or nurture? Does a person pick up a guitar and you've either got it or you don't, or can you cajole people into becoming more, exploring their musicianship? Which do you think it is?
I think it's both.
You do?
And I've used the analogy. I mean, if a kid can shoot baskets at 4 years old with his dad out in the driveway, and another kid down the block can't even get the ball, you know, there's an aptitude waiting to be developed, I think. And the nurturing gives you that chance to go for it if you have the aptitude. And that was my case.
Did your kids have any of that aptitude? Did it become the family business for either one of your kids or no?
Yeah, sure. My son, Travis.
Your son.
Carlton, he got the gift. When he was little, he would sit on my lap while I was at the mixing console, just doing rough mixes in my studio. And his body language, already at 3 years old, was in time with the music. He's a bass player. Right out of high school, he went to Musicians Institute out in L.A. And since then, that's been, 23 years ago now, he tours the world with me, and he tours the world with Robin Ford, and he tours the world with Scott Henderson, great guitar players. And just last year, he was asked to join Steve Gadd's band. So Travis got the gift.
My God. You were born in 1948.
Yes.
And when you're coming up, I'm assuming that someone who's as musically gifted as you is absorbing music early on. What was the music you were listening to in the 50s?
Yeah, I can remember my grandmother having Perry Como records, Dean Martin records. So yeah, in the early 50s, that was the music on the radio. And by the mid-50s, then doo-wop was coming. Rock and roll was being explored on the radio. So I was hearing all of that also.
And then Buddy Holly.
Yeah, sure. Chuck Berry, that. But in Los Angeles, I think it was a local television show. Every Saturday night, there was a country western TV show called The Town Hall Party. And the guitar player on that show was Joe Mafis. And he was the fastest damn guitar player you ever heard. And of course, as a kid, you're just, you know, you can't believe it. So it's inspiring. I got to see that on Saturday nights. So a lot of different kind of music I was listening to while starting to take guitar lessons.
Now, in my business, there's a similar component where you go to work for Spielberg and you show up and you just say, yes, sir, no, sir. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. A salute. Mm-hmm. Here's a guy that knows exactly what he wants from the first frame to the last frame. And you're there and you just want to say, tell me what you want me to do to help you make your movie. Now, other films I do with writer-directors who are more new, they want your input. Mm-hmm. Does that chasm exist in your business too? People who are very hands-on and then people who sit there and say, you tell me what you want to do.
Yeah. I was fortunate that after recording with the Crusaders in the early 70s when I was 23, and then a number of other hits right after that, the producers started calling me and leaving the paper blank. They wanted me to create something on their production that maybe they would not have thought of. So I was very fortunate that I had that kind of freedom.
Who pushed you the hardest? Someone, even when you were younger, and they knew they were in a room, they were in a studio with a young guy. I don't mean it in an abusive way. I don't mean it in a pejorative way. Who really pushed you, producer, and helped you?
Well, what comes to mind is in late 69, I was 21, got one of my first sessions for a film call on Universal, probably, subbing for some time. My name was on the list, and then they couldn't get the guy they wanted for the afternoon session. So I walk into the session, and it's all the heavy cats, and it's a Quincy Jones. He's doing Fat Albert for Cosby, the background music. Well, what Quincy would do with this is he'd have the score for small band, I don't know, three horns, blah, blah, blah. We would do a take. Maybe the guitar part was just chords, chunk, chunk, ka-chunk, chunk, nothing important. But then what Quincy would do is say, all right, now on this one, guitar take the flute part, flutes take the, he would reorchestrate it on the spot. So all of a sudden, I'm 21 years old walking into this heavy thing and they're going to hand me the flute part. He pushed me not knowing that that was really something I had never done before. Mm-hmm. Well, I made it. I made the parts, did a good job. Years and years later, after working off and on with Quincy, I asked him about that date. I said, I remember my first date. It was Fat Albert, blah, 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 and blah, blah. And I said, I walked out of there scared to death. He said, all I remember is you did a good job. In other words, he was doing his thing.
He cared about.
He cared about the guitar player playing the flute part. But I never forgot that because it showed me the challenges that could come up as a session player.
When you go into a room and you do what you do, is it really all the same? Meaning music is music and musicians have a certain language and a certain code. And it doesn't matter if it's Neil Diamond or, you know, James Ingram.
Sure.
You know, Michael Jackson. Is it really, there's an essential base of it that's just the same whoever you work with?
Yeah, the approach is the same. Like I said, they're expecting many of us, in the rhythm section especially, to come up with parts to enhance their song. And you take a great producer, arranger like Quincy Jones. When I got the call to play on Michael Jackson's She's Out of My Life, I got to the studio and Michael had already cut his vocal and Greg Fillingane's keyboard part was already cut. And that's all there was. And they wanted my guitar to somehow enhance this small production. So I did. I did what I liked. And then Quincy, I know at one part I played, I run through, and Quincy looked over at Bruce Swedeen, the engineer, and he said, will it print? And Bruce said, it's too low. So the engineer's input was he knew when he went to mix that record, my guitar part that I had felt was in the wrong range. I said, okay, Quincy said, okay, try some other things that aren't so low. So that kind of collaboration off of my creativity to their input made that final product.
They let you find your way.
Yes, but with their guidance.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some of my favorite music that you have played is with Steely Dan.
Mm-hmm.
I love Nightfly, and you played on Nightfly.
Yeah.
I love that album. But when you're with a duo like that, is there one of them that's more... Becker is renowned as being a very quiet guy. You know, he's not Fagan. Mm-hmm. And Fagan was much more colorful and much more articulate. And they wrote the songs together. But when you were in the studio with them, did they both contribute? Did they both have something to say about what they wanted you to do? Or one person took the lead?
I would say they were like brothers. And I'm thinking now, not on the tracking dates, but when I would be overdubbing guitar solo, they would listen and react. And one guy would say, oh, let's try it. Blah, 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 blah. And maybe next time it would be Donald saying, I really like that part right there. And they would collaborate. It was amazing. While we were doing the tracking dates, Donald was a little more involved because he was more sophisticated harmonically at the keyboard when they wrote those tunes. So he could interpret and get more involved in chord voicings and things like that. But I'm sure when they were collaborating, writing the tunes, the two of them together, their brains just went nuts and came up with those great songs.
Well, I mean, there's no song I know of more than Don't Take Me Alive. And the guitar playing you did. I mean, I listen to that, I mean, I get a chill.
I didn't tell this story for many years, but when The Royal Scam by Steely Dan did come out, there was a review in Rolling Stone raving about my kid Charlemagne solo.
Yeah.
And I hadn't thought of that song or that album since the session. And so got the record, put it on, listened to Kid Charlemagne with my then wife. And at the end of the song, I looked at her and I never forgot this. It was so honest. I said, it just sounds like me. I mean, really. So I'm glad the world reacted the way they did to it.
Right.
I didn't know it.
Yeah. How many recordings do you think you did with Steely Dan?
Well, Royal Scam, Asia, will include Nightfly in there with Donald. Gaucho was an interesting one. They cut that in New York, and I wasn't involved at all. But when the record came out, again, reviews were saying Larry Carlton's solo on Third World Man. I thought, I didn't play on that album. So the story was told to me later that the second engineer had erased one of their masters by accident, and they needed one more song for the Gaucho album, so they went back into the archives of the Royal Scam, and we had cut Third World Man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I ended up on Gaucho.
There was a lot of self-destructive behavior going on in the music business in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people that were self-immolating with drugs and alcohol and, you know, very talented people.
Yes.
Who ended up dead. Now, in your business, whether it's you or anyone else, do you find yourself sometimes sitting there going, I'll pass. I don't necessarily want to go into the studio with that person because they're a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not quite sure you want to work. Was there any of that for you? Were there people you came across? Again, no names, but people you thought, I'm not so interested.
Yes. And I have named this name before, and I think it's appropriate.
Right.
Phil Spector's office called me for 5 nights of recording with John Lennon. Mm-hmm. When he was producing him. And the other musicians, a couple of them, Leon Russell, myself. Mm-hmm. Bottom line, we get to the studio and for, let's say, a 6 p.m. session call. Well, nobody showed up, Phil or John, until like 9:30 or 10. And then we went out and we were going to cut the old rock and roll song, Boney Maroney.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I knew that was when I was a kid. I played Boney Maroney. But this was at a bad time for John. First time I'd ever met him. So he's sitting next to me and he's calling the chord changes to Boney Maroney. Well, there are three and I played it as a kid. So the bottom line was not a good time for John. The session was a drag. We waited 4 hours plus to play Boney Maroney. When I left the session, I drove Leon Russell back to the Sunset Marquee. And I said, man, that was a drag. And with his Oklahoma accent, he said, you kidding? I'm back to Tulsa in the morning. So I got home and immediately just went to my call and canceled the rest of the week for Phil Spector's thing. I didn't want to sit through that for 5 nights. A drunk artist, a late start. So it was a bad experience. And I guess some months later, I don't know how many months later, They did end up getting that album finished, but I didn't participate.
Right, right. Well, thank you for sharing that. And it's an interesting thing where people who have that problem, mm-hmm. like in my business, you know, I mean, it's very different. I think of music as I always say, acting is what you do when you have no musical talent. You were married and you have two children.
Yes.
And during the height of your career, you were living where, in Los Angeles?
Mm-hmm. Hollywood Hills, right above the pilgrimage.
Right. And the peripatetic nature of your business, was that tough on your family, you traveling all the time?
I would say yes. My first child, Katie Bug, she was born in 1980. So I was already 10 years into my session career and also moving out, you know, moving out of the session scene into the solo scene. So yeah, I started traveling more and more. And I would say it took a toll for sure, which you'll hear that story from a lot of players, I think.
Sure, sure.
I can remember when Katie was maybe 2 years old, I was sitting out in the driveway with her. This is one of those things that a dad never forgets, you know. And we were just hanging out, had my arm around her, just me and my little girl. And I remember being so in love with her that I looked down and I said, "I'll always take care of you." And it was a special moment for me because it just came out, you know. So yeah, and to this day, both of my children were very, very, very tight, even though we've gone through some things, of course, that all people
sure.
do.
Sure. Guitarist Larry Carlton. If you love conversations with gifted musicians who've played with the biggest names in the business, be sure to check out my episode with Paul McCartney's drummer, Abe Laboriel Jr.
You know, for me as a drummer, I'm not so much focused on what I'm playing. I'm focused on what they're doing and I'm listening to them. Like, I get to be the ultimate audience and just to sit there and to listen to these incredible musicians play and you know, they end up orbiting so far, and my job is just to make sure that we still know where they're tethered to, that we're not all going so far that we lose the audience.
Hear more of my conversation with Abe Laboriel Jr. at heresthething.org. After the break, Larry Carlton shares the story of his recovery from a near-death experience and his journey to be able to play music again.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Are you ready to take charge of your health journey? Look no further than Trinity School of Natural Health. With their flexible online programs, you can receive the comprehensive education you need to care for your loved ones or step into the thriving field of natural health. Why choose Trinity? Because their programs offer more than just coursework. You'll interact with experienced instructors, connect with like-minded peers, and even participate in optional live events to hone your skills. If you've ever thought about becoming a certified natural health professional, the CNHP program at Trinity School of Natural Health is the perfect certification course. You'll equip yourself with the knowledge and skills to make a real difference in the lives of others. Turn your passion for natural health into a rewarding career. Visit trinityschool.org today to learn more about the Certified Natural Health Professional Certification Program. Go to trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org. Trinity School of Natural Health. Transform your life. Transform the world.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Larry Carlton's collaborations with the biggest artists in music have been bringing down the house since the 1960s. After over two decades of musical success, tragically, Larry Carlton was also the victim of a senseless act of violence in 1998. Carlton would recover and go on to start the nonprofit Helping Innocent People. I asked him about the circumstances surrounding the vicious attack.
My home in the Hollywood Hills, at my basement studio, room 335 it was called, I was there to do charts for that evening's sessions. And under the carport, we had converted the garage into an office, and my manager worked out of that office with his secretary, so we were self-contained at the home. So yeah, I showed up that afternoon to go downstairs and do the charts for that evening sessions. And the entrance door to that office off of the carport was ajar. And I could see out the window that there were two young boys and a German Shepherd dog jogging. So I walked over to the door because it was ajar and I was going to shut it so the dog wouldn't come in the office. And when I got to the door, the boys were right about entering the carport, and I was going to say, "Hey guys, I'm just going to shut the..." Shot me, and then they ran off. And the physical part of what I remember at that moment is my left arm went numb. I thought I was shot in the arm.
Good God.
But I was shot in the throat, and that traumatized all the nerves to my left arm. So that's how the event started.
And what would you attribute? Because you'd say an injury to that part of the body seems 99% it would be fatal for those of... I don't understand physiognomy, but yeah. What do you attribute to the fact that you survived?
A lot of luck.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The paramedics were right down the hill from my home, and they got the call that there had been a gunshot wound within minutes. The secretary called 911, and they were on the way back from another call, so they just turned and came right up the hill, and they put pressure. You know, I got hit in the carotid, so I have a half-inch graft in my carotid artery here on the left side. And they rushed me to St. Joseph's, which was, what, 7-8 minutes down the hill, and both surgeons, the best they had, happened to be there that day. And so that was the start. Yeah, they put the graft in, and from there, they said, "We know he's a guitar player, and we've looked at the trauma to his left arm nerves. He will play again, but we don't know at what level." So that's how that part started. And of course, many, 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 many months of physical therapy to regenerate the nerves from the upper part of my arm down to my fingertips was pretty unbelievable. Mm. And then from all that, it came back with hard work. And I only have, Alec, you're probably aware, I only have one vocal cord that functions. Mm-hmm. So luckily, my left vocal cord was over the midline, so the right vocal cord can touch it and I can talk. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I would have just died. I wouldn't have been able to close off. I would have choked to death. So in a nutshell, that's the trauma of being shot in the Hollywood Hills. And lastly, the detectives obviously did their job over the months and months and months. And the conclusion that they came to was it was a gang initiation shooting. Two kids, one of them has to go out and shoot Joe Citizen, not just Larry Carlton, but shoot the citizen. The other kid watches. They can go back and say, "Yep, he did it." So he could be...
They never caught them.
No.
Mm. I'm so sorry. How awful. How traumatizing.
Woo. Yeah.
How traumatizing. To get shot there, of all places. It's like, I mean, there's a lot of other places you get shot, obviously, that are from the neck up that would be problematic. But my God, God bless you that you survived that. That's amazing. Who's someone you wished you played with from another era? How far did you miss getting to work with Sinatra or someone like that?
Yeah. Didn't do Sinatra, but did Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., because Jimmy Bowen was the producer of Sinatra and all that stuff. So I was on Jimmy's list, worked for him all the time. Someone I wish I could have played one song with live would have been McCoy Tyner.
Why?
Because the John Coltrane Quartet influenced my emotions so much as a young musician, meaning 14 years old, 13, 14, 15 years old. When I heard that group play, I mean, Coltrane, so soulful, and the way McCoy, that whole unit just thrilled me emotionally as a young musician. In my prime, I wish I could have played one blues song with McCoy Tyner live, just to experience it. And I would have felt completely out of my league, but I wanted to experience that because he and Coltrane, that thing became so important to me. I think the reason, Alec, humbly, that I can play so melodically and hopefully so soulful and sometimes so simply is because of my response to the Coltrane album, Ballads. All John Coltrane does is play the damn song. No licks, no nothing. And slayed me emotionally.
Now, a person you have an important relationship with, it seems, is Robin Ford.
Yeah.
And how did that come about?
After I had recorded with Joni Mitchell and with Tom Scott and the LA Express, which was basically the band that we backed Joni with in the studio for Court and Spark, and Hejira and those albums. Joni and Tom wanted me to go on the road, and also they wanted Joe Sample and I to go on the road to support the Court and Spark album that we did with Joni. Well, Joe and I were still touring with the Crusaders somewhat, and both still involved in studio work, so we didn't want to go on the road. Well, Tom Scott knew about this kid up in San Francisco named Robin Ford. So they brought Robin in to take my place with the LA Express and the Joni Mitchell tour. And they asked me to come over to the rehearsal and kind of meet Robin and show him my setup. And after that, shortly after that, Robin was playing at that jazz club I mentioned earlier at Dante's with someone. Shit, this kid played the hell out of the guitar. And I went, oh boy, there's one of those guys. So I wanted to meet him. Invited him to my house. We jammed downstairs, just the two guitars. I wanted to hear this kid play, and we became good friends.
Mm. Well, for a man that played with a range of people, from Cass Elliot to Peter Gabriel to Leslie Gore to James Ingram and Michael Jackson and Giroux and on and on and on, I just want to say what a great honor it was to get to meet you.
Thank you.
I play music and you're on there, and your contribution to the music you make, and you have played every kind of music. I mean, it just is uncanny, the range of your talent and the range of your career. It's remarkable.
Thank
have you.
You
enjoyed it?
Of course. You're kidding. One of the most blessed musicians in the world.
Yeah, and one of the most talented.
Thanks, Alec. Thank you, buddy.
Guitarist Larry Carlton. My next guest, drumming legend Steve Gadd, has spent a career keeping time for the best of the best in music. That's Gadd on drums playing Sister Sadie with his band Steve Gadd and Friends, from the 2010 album Live at the Voce. I wanted to know, when you're hired by heavyweights like Chet Baker, Paul Simon, Quincy Jones, or Gladys Knight, who is in charge of the studio session?
Yeah, it's different. Every situation is a little different. But it could be the artist. It could be the producer. A lot. Most of the time, it's a combination. You know, we're in there. We're looking for an agreement. the creative process, you know, you can interject what you feel when the right time is, you know what I mean? Everybody's opinion is important. It's just that you have to know the right time to sort of, to put, you know, to get involved. And, you know, the more recording I did, the more I got used to doing that.
You learn the ropes.
Yeah. And how to work with people, how to understand what they're, you know, it's tricky when they're asking verbally for something musically.
Right.
It's hard to always to understand, you know what I mean? So it's a process of getting to know each other and trust each other. And for me, not to be afraid to try things maybe that I didn't necessarily come up with, but things that they thought that might work. And sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But that's the process, you know, trial and error. And just trying to come up with the agreement.
So you're in the room, you're in the studio with the whole battalion, or I want you to teach me about, is it people individually? Because a lot of times you see performers recording these seminal things, and it's the guy singing the vocals by himself, or she's singing the vocals by herself. Do you do the drumming by yourself sometimes with cans on, and you're listening to the track, and you're drumming and nobody else is there?
Yeah, that's the thing that's happened later on. You know, the equipment, you can go in by yourself. They got the tracks already done, and you just, you know, try to fit in. But with no other people there.
How did you feel about that? Doesn't sound as fun.
Well, you know, back in the 70s, the live thing was fun for a lot of different reasons. You know right. what I mean? There were a lot of different things going on.
Yeah.
But looking back, we spent a lot of time, you know, going over tracks, and if there was a mistake, you'd have to do a whole other take.
Yes.
And they were editing things. But now, with the computers, people can do the guitar and bass stuff and keyboard stuff, and then they can do it all separately to a click track.
And they can have you come in, I would imagine, and do like even a snippet. They might say, this little piece, writer, just give us that. We don't need you to do the whole take.
They could do that, you know, and that's one of the nice things about the way recording is done today. You don't have to do the whole track again.
Right.
They can really go in and just pick and choose what they want to do and go for that. So time-wise, it works, but it's definitely not as much fun as it used to be.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But maybe healthier.
Well, it's healthier and more time efficient, I think.
It's more time efficient. Now, at some point, Steve Gadd is this kid from Rochester. He's playing the drums. He goes and, you know, his uncle plays the drums. He's in a big band. You're 11 years old. How does it start?
Well, in the 70s, my whole life I've been playing drums. You know, in grammar school I started taking lessons. And then in high school I was in the drum corps. And I was in the military. I was in the Army band for 3 years, 5 years in music college. That's all I ever wanted to do. My goal was to, if I could support myself playing music, that was it. So after the Army, I went to New York. Someone I went to school with, Tony Levin, bass player.
Right.
We were in college together and worked with Gap Mangione, Chuck Mangione's brother.
Is this at Eastman or at...
This is at Eastman, and in Rochester, New York.
Right.
With Tony and I were at Eastman School of Music together.
Because you went to Manhattan first.
I went to 2 years to Manhattan because my grades weren't really good enough to get into...
That's a very prestigious school, yeah.
Yeah, so I got my grades up at Manhattan School of Music, transferred back to Eastman, which is in my hometown, right. Rochester. So not only was I doing things in school, in ensembles and orchestras, but I was working with Chuck and Gap Mangione, you know, six nights a week. So there was I was playing a lot. And I got to New York, and a couple of things started happening. My father got terminally ill. And my first marriage, you know, started falling apart. And music was the only thing in those years that I felt like I was doing anything that was good, positive, where I was able to do something and felt like I was giving people what they were looking for. It was just perfect timing for me. I was ready. I was hungry. I had, you know, studied a lot. My reading was good. So music was the thing that was like my escape from all of these other things that were just falling apart. Plus, I was getting high and stuff. I was taking cocaine because a lot of work was coming in.
Was it a struggle to stop, or did you stop pretty briskly? Were you able to control it, or did it drag on for a while? You trying?
It went on for like 15 years.
I was
hitting it. And it was not easy to stop. You know, I ended up in a hospital in Brooklyn. And then from there, I went to St. Mary's Rehab. My idea was I'd go and, you know, relax for a month till the heat was off. And then I'd go out and start hitting it again, you know what I mean? And something happened in rehab where the second step, like, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It dawned on me that I was completely out of my mind,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know.
And I had never... Up until that point, I thought that everyone else was the cause of my problems. You know, I could blame it on anybody. And I was the last person I would look at, you know what I mean?
Right.
But when I finally looked at myself and saw that I was nuts.
Now, eventually you become someone where the phone doesn't stop ringing. I have a list in front of me. They gave me a list that has to be 20 pages long of the tracks that you've played on, and that's just some of them. Eventually, you become a guy where the phone doesn't stop ringing. Everybody, you know, who can, they want you to come play the drums for them. When do you believe that happened and why? When do you start to get into the room with the people who are really at the top of the game? Who calls you first?
Well, I mean, back in those days, Paul Simon was the first really huge, you know, music celebrity.
Yeah.
And Phil Ramone was producing him. And... it's a process of getting to know each other, but, you know, I think I was the right person for Paul at that time.
Right.
I wasn't just like a studio guy that did one genre. I mean, I loved a lot of different genres of music.
And that's Paul. Yeah, Paul was very diversified then.
Paul, he's always looking for a new way to do it.
What was the album, the first album you did with him?
Still Crazy After All These Years. Wow. The first song I ever recorded with him was... what the hell, have a good time.
Right. Now, when you do something with someone like Paul, I'm assuming there must be a diversity of people who say, we're going to do this, and you do like 50 takes, and there's people who do 3 takes. Have you just seen the gamut and the range of people who like, let's just do this quickly, and I'm happy, or they're like really, really, really picky-yune and detailed?
Well, yeah, there's both. I mean, Paul is very picky. Fagan, you know, Steely Dan, they were, you know, really picky too. You know, it's like they had something in mind that they wanted, but they didn't know what it was until they heard it.
That's funny.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And when you struggled as an artist and you're with these big people now, you're at the top and you stay at the top for quite a while, you know, you stay there, man. I mean, but when you're there, were there people who you would struggle and struggle and struggle and work and work and work it? And then when you got it, did they like look at you and go, God, that's it? And they were happy? Or did they just, was it just business and they got up and they walked out and they were like, thanks?
You know what? Back in those days, it was like, you know, they were happy.
Yeah.
It was
a brotherhood.
It was a brotherhood, and it was about the music.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't about what market we're targeting and things like that. It was just about, they had something they wanted to say that was important to them. And everybody, it was important to everybody involved, you know, to the engineer, to the producer, to the artist, and to the musicians. Studio musicians, you know, they want to hang in there until we get the take, you know what I mean? They don't want to give up and let it go.
Who were the people you work with? Like, are you in a room and Clapton plays and you sit there and go, Jesus Christ, look at this guy, look at him. Who did you admire?
There's many people I admire. Chuck Rainey, Richard T., Cornell Dupree, all these guys that were on these sessions that, you know, these guys used to work with Aretha and King Curtis. And there was so much history, you know, they had been a part of writing the book, you know what I mean? There was so much to learn by having the opportunity to play with these guys.
I'm assuming you have your drum kit or multiple drum kits, and they take it to the studio, they ship it for you, and you set it up and everything, and you don't play on somebody else's kit.
Most of the time it's on, you know, it's my own,
yeah.
You know, most of it. Sometimes it's not, but most of the time it is.
You bring in your kit.
Yeah.
And your kit that you have now is one that you found when? You've been playing the same kit for how long?
Well, this last kit was probably about 15, 20 years.
It's a while.
I've been playing, yeah.
And what do you like about it?
I like the sizes. I like birch wood for toms and maple for a bass drum. And there's a metal snare, so it's,
out there right now is writing all this down. That's a drummer.
Let me tell you something. There's so many different kinds of equipment out there. I don't know how anyone,
yeah,
would really know how to choose.
But you didn't become so technically spoiled or whatever, where you walk in and go, oh fuck, the mic's a Sennheiser, and I'd rather have a whatever. You didn't care.
I let the engineer do that.
Exactly.
I do what I do, and they do what they do, and I try to work with them.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's the idea. And I not tell them how to do it, but just let them do what they do and work together to try and just, you know, make the music happen.
Yeah. Drummer Steve Gadd. If you're enjoying this conversation, don't keep it to yourself. Tell a friend. And follow Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, Steve Gadd shares how his inescapable talent spared him from serving in Vietnam.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Are you ready to take charge of your health journey? Look no further than Trinity School of Natural Health. With their flexible online programs, you can receive the comprehensive education you need to care for your loved ones or step into the thriving field of natural health. Why choose Trinity? Because their programs offer more than just coursework. You'll interact with experienced instructors, connect with like-minded peers, and even participate in optional live events to hone your skills. If you've ever thought about becoming a certified natural health professional, the CNHP program at Trinity School of Natural Health is the perfect certification course. You'll equip yourself with the knowledge and skills to make a real difference in the lives of others. Turn your passion for natural health into a rewarding career. Visit trinityschool.org today to learn more about the Certified Natural Health Professional Certification Program. Go to trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org. Trinity School of Natural Health. Transform your life. Transform the world.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing. That's Steve Gadd and the Gadd Gang performing the song Little Brother live in 1988. Gadd co-wrote the song with Richard T. Steve Gadd was a bit of a musical prodigy when he picked up his instrument at the ripe age of 4. By 11, he had played with the likes of bandleader Dizzy Gillespie. I wanted to know how he came to sit in with the legendary trumpeter at such a young age.
Yeah, let me tell you, in Rochester, when I was growing up, there was a lot of music going on. And there was this club called the Ridgecrest Inn, a small little club. And they brought in Gene Krupa, Kay Winding, Dizzy Gillespie, Carmen McRae.
Wow.
And they used to have Sunday afternoon matinees, you know what I mean? Like from, you know, like 4 to 6. And, you know, sometimes they'd let people sit in the matinees. And, you know, the artists were so gracious, they'd let us kids sit in. You know, we were kids, we were hungry to, you know, I got a chance to see Gene Krupa and sit in with him. Growing up in that atmosphere was tremendous.
Yeah, there's a scene then in Rochester, because people forget that when Kodak was humming, when everything was film, Rochester was a very important city, you know.
It was booming. Kodak, Xerox, Bausch and Lomb, General Dynamics, you know. There was a lot going on. There was a lot of music, a lot of clubs, a lot of music. And this one club brought in the big names like Dizzy. And because we frequented the place, the owner of the club would, you know, introduce the families to the artist and, you know, let them know that these kids are serious, you know what I mean? And Chuck's parents would invite Dizzy and the band over to their house for spaghetti and stuff. So it was, you know, and
sweet.
And in those days, the same bands would come back in, you know, like they'd, so you'd get to know them. That was the circuit, you know. There were no big venues back then, you know. And Dizzy gave Chucky a trumpet, you know, a trumpet with the bell that went up. And Art Blakey gave me a cymbal. You know, one time Papa Joe Jones was playing at the club with Tommy Bryant and his brother Ray Bryant playing bass. And something happened in New York to Papa Joe Jones' kid, got in an accident or something, so he had to leave. And the owner of the club called my parents and asked if I could go in and play the night with Tommy and Ray Bryant, man. It was like, I was, you know, maybe I was like 11 or 12 years old, but, you know, it was unbelievable.
Now, were you excited when you were told you were relieved of combat duty so you could play the drums for 3 years in the Army?
Well, you know, in those years, if you weren't in college or you had some kind of deferment, you were going to end up in Vietnam.
In the jungle. That's the way it was.
Yeah. And so a lot of guys in music in music college during the last year, my teacher, John Beck, hooked me up with an audition for the Army Field Band in Fort Meade, Maryland. And I was accepted. And, you know, so you go to basic training and then you report for duty at Fort Meade. And you're in the States for the whole time. We were the, you know, official touring band for the Army in those years, and we would, you know, drive across the states and do concerts at different high schools, you know, trying to, you know, just promote the armed forces. And so, yeah, I knew I wasn't going to have to, if I took the Army gig, I wasn't going to have to go to Vietnam.
Right. So you played your ass off.
Yeah, I played my ass off. But when I graduated, I waited to see if I was going to get my draft papers, because the Army Field Band said I had till October to enlist, you know, and I graduated in June, and July I got my draft papers. So I just, you know, they said I just enlisted before I was supposed to report for the draft and avoided, you know, going to Vietnam.
Now, modern music, contemporary music for you, when you want to lay down and just sit back and, you know, stare at the rainstorm, what's a music that comforts you? What's a music you enjoy?
Well, I used to like to put on Stevie Wonder songs in the key of life. Little Feet, Leon Russell, you know, Delaney and Bonnie, wow. Ray Charles.
Yeah. I'm like, give me Nat King Cole.
Nat King Cole. Well, I love Nat King Cole. I love Louis Armstrong. I listen to a lot of the old things, man. They mean a lot to me, and they always get me. They always get me.
Yeah, they always get you. Well, listen, let me just say this to you. I want to say thank you. You are so humble. You have so much humility. And you go online and you read about you, and my God, everybody, you got all these guys who were like drum freaks and music freaks, and they're going, now, let me show you this thing that Steve Gadd did. And you would never know it from how sweet and how kind you've been in this interview. I'm very grateful to you.
Well, I was excited to do this, man. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
My thanks to Steve Gadd and Larry Carlton. I'll leave you with a little more of Larry Carlton's brilliance on Steely Dan's Don't Take Me Alive. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's The Thing is brought to you by iHeart Radio.
Are you ready to take charge of your health journey? Look no further than Trinity School of Natural Health. With their flexible online programs, you can receive the comprehensive education you need to care for your loved ones or step into the thriving field of natural health. Why choose Trinity? Because their programs offer more than just coursework. You'll interact with experienced instructors, connect with like-minded peers, and even participate in optional live events to hone your skills. If you've ever thought about becoming a certified natural health professional, the CNHP program at Trinity School of Natural Health is the perfect certification course. You'll equip yourself with the knowledge and skills to make a real difference in the lives of others. Turn your passion for natural health into a rewarding career. Visit trinityschool.org today to learn more about the Certified Natural Health Professional Certification Program. Go to trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org. Trinity School of Natural Health. Transform your life. Transform the world.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.